of Myself by Matthew Sweet, who recently had a debilitating stroke on tour, and fans are now raising funds for his recovery. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Health workers in northern Gaza have been forced to postpone the latest phase of the polio vaccination program as Israel continues to carry out a deadly campaign of forced expulsion and starvation in northern Gaza. Earlier today, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned Israel's actions, saying, quote, "People suffering under the ongoing Israeli siege in North Gaza are rapidly exhausting all available means for their survival." Doctors in northern Gaza have described horrific conditions as hospitals are overwhelmed and remaining medical staff are unable to treat the injured. Dr. Hussam Abu Safia is the director of Kamal Adwan Hospital.
We're talking on the 18th day of an imposed complete siege on the medical establishment and the North Gaza Strip. We appealed yesterday, the day before yesterday, and today we call on the world that the Kamal Adwan medical supply storage is at zero. We have no blood bags that we can offer to the wounded, no medical supplies or urgently needed medicine. Some members of our medical staff are either martyred, killed, or injured. A little while ago, we received one of our colleagues who was martyred, Dr. Mohammed Ghanem. He was offering humanitarian services at one of the medical checkpoints in a shelter. The situation is catastrophic. We will be facing a humanitarian catastrophe if there is no solution to this situation in the next few coming hours. The hospital will turn into a mass grave. There is a huge number of wounded people, and approximately every hour we lose one of them as a martyr. The wounded turn into martyrs due to the absence of needed medical supplies. Tools and medical staff were either detained, wounded, or martyred. Our medical staff and ambulances cannot get the wounded out of the street of Beit Lahia. We are talking about the wounded who managed to come to the hospital. They arrive and we give them our services. Those who cannot come to us stay in the streets and are martyred. This is what is happening in the north of Gaza.
That was Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, director of the Kamal Adwan Hospital in Beit Lahia in northern Gaza. And this is Lina Issam Abu Nada, a Palestinian who recently fled Beit Lahia.
I fled the intense bombardment in Beit Lahia. Martyrs and remains were all scattered on the ground. We do not know where to go. Truly, we don't know what state we have reached. I swear by God, what we are going through is the hardest situation in days. Even the occupation, Israel, took my brother as they put all the men on one side and let us leave. The tank moved and covered us with dust. On top of everything, no one is standing for us. We ask you, with all the mercy you have, to stand beside us. What's happening to us is unfair. We cannot take it anymore. We are being exterminated in Gaza. We are dying, and no one is standing beside us, nor is anyone able to solve our issue. We are innocent. We have nothing to do with everything that has happened. We are lost between a war and an extermination. We can't take it anymore.
A Palestinian woman who recently fled Beit Lahia. Earlier this week, the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem accused Israel of committing ethnic cleansing in northern Gaza. We go now to Tel Aviv, Israel, where we're joined by B'Tselem's international advocacy lead, Sarit Mikhaeli. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Sarit. Explain what you mean by ethnic cleansing and what exactly you understand is happening in northern Gaza and how much Israelis understand what is happening right nearby.
So thank you, Amy, very much for the opportunity to be with you today. I think B'Tselem decided to make this statement as really an act of desperation. It's impossible for us to continue to watch, to observe the very little information we are getting from northern Gaza, the very, fragmented information, and not conclude that what is going on there is the deliberate pressuring by the Israeli army of the civilian population of the area to move out of this area in order to empty it of Palestinians. This is ethnic cleansing, the definition that we would argue is the Israeli current actions on the ground. And I think it's important to remember that this is happening within a context. The context is not only increasing and ongoing reports that this is the Israeli policy, that this notion of the so-called island plan or the general's plan that called on Israel to essentially starve the population of northern Gaza in order to get it to move out of the way, right? So that's one element of the picture. And then the second element is that there is a growing debate, there is a growing level of activism within the Israeli far right to demand the settling of northern Gaza. Now, this is the context to what we are seeing on the ground at the moment. I think it's important also to mention that the Israeli army itself has admitted in a response to a high court petition submitted by several Israeli human rights organizations that for the first 2 weeks of this month, no humanitarian aid was allowed in to North Gaza. That was deliberate. That was knowingly. That isn't something that the Israeli authorities deny. That, and in addition, in the response submitted yesterday to the High Court, Israel also states that this is continuing when it comes to Jabalia. And we know that yesterday, the Israeli army issued some drone footage showing throngs of civilians walking out from the Jabalia refugee camp towards the south, and also saying that Israel managed to break the so-called Hamas siege on Jabalia, and said that about 20,000 civilians have already left. From our perspective, all this indicates one clear goal, which is to remove the people from northern Gaza, to empty that area. I also think, and we can maybe discuss it a bit in more length later on, there are also quite open admissions within the Israeli media that some of this is happening. Certainly not in the framing of an international crime, but commentators have accepted on some levels that this is what Israel is doing now in North Gaza.
Well, let me just read, Sarit Mikhaili, what the media has said. This is on Israel's Channel 12. The chief political analyst saying, quote, "We can keep denying that what's happening is an implementation of the general's plan, emptying of the strip, starving the terrorists, eliminating them, capturing them. That's, in my opinion, what's happening here." So, in effect, would you say that the general's plan itself constitutes ethnic cleansing? And then to what extent do people in Israel believe that that's what's occurring? If it's being said in the media, is there some consensus around it? Although I will note that what he said was starving the terrorists, eliminating them, not the general population there.
Well, first of all, I want to be clear that Israel, we suspect, and as we also announced together with colleagues in other human rights organizations last week, we suspect that Israel is implementing the spirit, I would say, maybe not necessarily every single aspect of this so-called general's plan, but that is quietly implementing this. And this is why we also called last week on the international community to really take responsibility for what is going on in Gaza. And we stated openly that it's not just Israeli policymakers who should be held accountable and face consequences for these crimes, but also that the international community cannot be considered complicit if Israel goes ahead and empties North Gaza of its inhabitants. I think that when we look at this plan, this absolutely horrific plan, it includes provisions that are absolutely and clearly war crimes and could probably also be viewed as crimes against humanity. The idea is actually to basically starve the population out in order to leave the area. And then, according to this plan, and certainly I don't agree with any aspect of the logic, the only people remaining will be terrorists, and then they can just be killed off. This is the again, I don't want to simplify too much, but this is the essential logic of this plan. But it is absolutely in contradiction with many of the known facts we know about the situation in Gaza and in North Gaza. The fact that many of the civilians there cannot leave or don't want to leave. Some of them cannot leave because it's impossible for them to move around, because they just have no other place to go, or they don't want to leave these areas because they know that the same sort of fate of being bombarded and exposed to Israeli attacks can, wait for them in the many internally displaced camps throughout Gaza, where people are not safe in any way. So there are many reasons why Palestinians would not want to leave North Gaza. So that's the first issue. The second issue, and certainly the idea that you can somehow force them out permanently, right, without not for their own security, is absolutely illegal. The second issue that is very clearly part of the illegality and the shocking lack of morals, I would say, also moral failure of this plan, is that the idea that you can somehow decide that after a certain moment where you say you told all civilians to leave a certain area, that means that everyone left in there is a combatant, a terrorist, and you can just kill them. That is also not true. That's simply not the way international humanitarian law goes. Civilians don't lose their protective status if you gave them an illegal and probably also impossible to implement evacuation order. The idea that somehow a person should be considered a legitimate military target, regardless of what they're actually doing, because they happen to be in a certain place that the Israeli army decided is no longer acceptable, that is not legal. That is clearly a war crime. And I have to also say that this isn't just things we are saying here at B'Tselem. In recent days, there have been several much more mainstream Israelis, including the former deputy leader of the Israeli National Security Council, who also said that these kinds of orders would be orders that a black flag is flying over. These would be orders to commit war crimes, and that soldiers have to refuse to obey these kinds of orders. This is, as I said, this is a former Israeli security official. I think it's really important to remember also, though, that the current situation on the ground, unfortunately, isn't... And again, I say it with a great deal of pain, isn't really influenced by statements by human rights organizations like B'Tselem, by actions by Israeli, wonderful and just very courageous Israeli human rights organizations that are now petitioning the High Court, because we just simply don't have the capacity to influence the reality on the ground at the moment. That is why that is the essential source of our call.
So, Sarit Mekhaeli, we just have a minute. We just have a minute. I want to go to that issue of the call of the international community, and particularly the U.S. Blinken has just left Israel, his 11th trip there, saying he's pushing for a ceasefire. Yet at the same time, the Biden administration continuing to arm Netanyahu. In this last 30 seconds, your thoughts on that kind of approach, saying he should push for a ceasefire, but we'll continue to arm you.
It's absolutely clear that we must have a ceasefire. We need a ceasefire and we need the hostage deal now. But this isn't going to happen unless Prime Minister Netanyahu is placed in a situation where he has to accept this. And we do not see this happening at the moment. I think the thought that somehow the U.S. administration can ask Netanyahu, can urge Netanyahu for a ceasefire, and this will actually happen, is simply unrealistic. There needs to be intense pressure to get Israel to currently accept a ceasefire, to stop what it's doing in northern Gaza. And it has to come from action by the United States and the international community. Otherwise, they will also be complicit in what we're seeing now.
Sarit Michaeli, I want to thank you for being with us, International Advocacy Lead for the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, which has accused the Israeli military of committing ethnic cleansing in northern Gaza. Next up, we look at Israel's intensifying war on journalists in Gaza, two critically wounded journalists not able to get out of Gaza, and Israel saying that six journalists are members of Hamas or Palestinian Jihad. What that means. We'll speak with the head of Committee to Protect Journalists. Stay with us.
I will wait in the morning if you call, and I'll stand beside you long as I can. I will hold back the
Crumble With You If You Fall, covered by Bernice Johnson-Regan, produced by Barbara Dane and released on the Paradon Records label she co-founded. Barbara Dane died this week at the age of 97. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to Israel's intensifying war on journalists. On Wednesday, the Israeli military publicly accused six Al Jazeera journalists of being members of Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Press freedom groups blasted the Israeli military for releasing what some have described as a kill list for the journalists. In a statement, Al Jazeera said, quote, Al Jazeera categorically rejects the Israeli occupation forces' portrayal of our journalists as terrorists and denounces their use of fabricated evidence. The network views these fabricated accusations as a blatant attempt to silence the few remaining journalists in the region, thereby obscuring the harsh realities of the war from audiences worldwide. This comes as Israel continues to block the evacuation of two Al Jazeera camera operators who were severely injured after being shot by Israeli troops. One of the journalists, Fadi Al-Wahidi, has been in a coma after being shot in the neck.
We're joined now by Jody Ginsberg, Chief Executive Officer of the Committee to Protect Journalists here in New York. Jody, let's start with the two journalists who are gravely wounded. One of them is paralyzed and in a coma. Israel's not letting them be evacuated. Can you talk about the significance of this?
Well, yes. Fadi has been in a coma for over a week now, and not just in a coma, but with no access to painkillers. We've heard, obviously, about the ongoing bombardment in Gaza and what that has meant for hospitals. Al Jazeera has asked repeatedly, used all the formal channels to request their evacuation, and so far has had no reply. And this follows a pattern in which journalists appear to be being punished for doing their work, for exposing what's happening inside Gaza.
And Jody Ginsberg, if you could, let's go to these six Al Jazeera journalists who've been accused by Israel of being terrorists. You have pointed to, the CPJ has pointed to contradictory information that's been released by the IDF in the past, at least one recent instance. Ismail Al-Ghul, explain who he was and what the IDF said about him.
So Ismail Al-Ghul was an Al Jazeera correspondent. He was killed along with a freelance camera operator, Rami Al-Rafi, near Gaza City in July. And the IDF alleged that Al-Ghul was an engineer in a Hamas brigade, and that justified his killing. They published a document which they said was a record of Hamas military activity as proof of these accusations. Some of the information indicated that Al-Ghul, who was born in 1997, had received a Hamas military ranking in 2007, so he would have been 10 years old. So the document was not, in our view, credible. And unfortunately, this is not a one-off incident. There is a pattern of Israel making these kinds of allegations, providing evidence that is frankly not credible, or in some cases, no evidence at all.
Jody, especially, you know, talk about the significance of Israel doing this now. No one else, no other reporter is in Gaza. It's only Al Jazeera reporters who are. Over 4,000 journalists have traveled to Israel to cover this war since October last year, but no other journalists have been permitted in.
It's hugely significant. This is the deadliest conflict for journalists that CPJ has ever documented. 128 journalists at least have been killed, 126 of them by Israel, and most of those are Palestinians. And in many cases, we believe those journalists who have been deliberately targeted for being journalists. Now, you're right that the major issue in all of this is that those journalists who remain are the only people who are able to provide us information about what's happening inside Gaza. No journalist from outside Gaza has been allowed in since the start of that war, and that's highly unusual. I speak to lots of war correspondents who've covered many, many wars over decades, and all of them talk about how unprecedented this is, you know, to not have any access whatsoever. And that, of course, puts additional pressure on these journalists. And what you have when you have these kinds of accusations from Israel that the journalists are terrorists is a kind of justification for then killing them.
So you have Democratic Congress member James McGovern leading 64 other Congress members in a letter to Biden and Blinken, urging them to push for Israel to allow in international journalists. At the same time, Jody Ginsburg, if you can talk about the number of journalists who've been killed in Gaza, isn't this unprecedented?
It's totally unprecedented. This number is. More journalists were killed in the first 10 weeks of the war, just the first 10 weeks of the war, than have ever been killed in a single country over an entire year. That gives you some sense of the scale of this. Those journalists who remain are trying desperately to cover the impact of the war while suffering the same effects of the war as everyone else, the deprivations of food, the lack of shelter, the continual displacement, the lack of equipment. And as we have fewer and fewer journalists reporting and the challenge becomes greater and greater, of course, we have less and less information coming out of Gaza. And it's absolutely essential that we have that information, that we have those images, so that the international community can understand the scale of what's happening.
Jody Ginsburg, finally, if you could put this in a broader context, is there any other precedent for Europe, the U.S., or any of its allies restricting access to all international journalists to a war zone for over a year, as has happened here?
There's no precedent like this. In wars, inevitably, one side or other will restrict access to journalists. That we see that frequently. But it is unheard of that not a single international journalist has been able to get into Gaza for an entire year. And remember that it's not just about the access. Of course, that's a major issue. But we have Gazan journalists doing phenomenal work in Gaza and in the West Bank. It's not just about the access. It's also about the attacks that we've seen on media facilities, which is civilian infrastructure. We've seen repeated communications blackouts. We've seen the banning of Al Jazeera and the closure of the Al Jazeera Ramallah Bureau. So it's not simply, we've seen arrests of journalists, both in Gaza and the West Bank. So it's not simply the dangers, the killing of journalists, egregious as that is, it's the whole pattern and systematic attempts, and quite successful attempts, to censor what is happening inside Gaza.
Jody Ginsburg, I want to thank you for being with us, CEO of the Committee to Protect Journalists. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We end today's show with a Muslim American Democrat who was ejected from a Kamala Harris rally in Metro Detroit, where Harris was joined by Republican former Congressmember Liz Cheney. Ahmad Ghanem is a Democratic Party activist and former House candidate from Michigan's 11th District.
He joins us now from Oak Park, Michigan, not far from the Harris campaign event, which he was ejected from. The Kamala Harris campaign has since said it regrets his removal. Thank you so much for being with us, Ahmad Ghanem. In this few minutes that we have left, take us to the event that you were invited to and explain what happened.
Thank you for having me. So basically, I went like anyone else. I was dressed in a suit going to this event, stood in line. It was a small event by invite, only 200 people at, there, less than 200 people. I went through securities like the airport security where they have to check everything. They take even the signs that you have from the campaign. So nobody had any signs. You only had have your wallet and that's it. And I was cleared by security. I was seated like anyone. I was sitting there for like 10 or 15 minutes just trying to answer some emails. I did not engage with anybody in conversation because they seat you randomly with people you don't know around you. And after 10 minutes, a lady came and told me, can you follow me? And I thought probably they are changing my seat. I said, that's fine. I followed her. And at the door, I found two police officers waiting for me and said, they don't want you here at the event. If you either leave now or I put you in a police car. And that was shocking to me. So I was sitting there and I did nothing. And now I'm threatened to be arrested or have to leave. And I was just asking, I told him, okay, I'm going to leave. I just want to know, why are you kicking me out? And he said, it is not me, it's the venue that's kicking you out. So I asked him, why would the venue kick me out? The venue, they don't know anything about me, it's just the venue. He said, I didn't know. And the lady that escorted me out, she ended the conversation. I said, this is not a conversation anymore. You have to be escorted out. So I didn't want to escalate the situation, and I just left.
And Ahmed, can you say whether since you've left, have you heard anything further about why you were removed?
No. The campaign issued a brief statement saying they regret what happened. They gave me a call. I thanked them for the call, but I said, I want to know, why was I removed? Because apology without accountability is not an apology. So far, they did not provide any information on or any reason why they removed me.
So, Ahmed Ghanem, you were a congressional candidate. You didn't win the primary. You got 15,000 votes. After you were kicked out of the Kamala Harris event, the Trump campaign approached you to make an ad?
That's correct. They approached me to make an ad against Haley, against Vice President Harris. And they said this ad will be aired everywhere, on CNN, everywhere, but we want you to film it. And I said, no, I cannot do that.
Why do you feel that? I mean, of course, President Trump, well known when his first acts in office as president was the Muslim ban. But if you can explain what you're demanding now of the Kamala Harris campaign.
I'm demanding a reason why they ejected me from the campaign without anything. I didn't have any Palestinian kufiya. I didn't have any pens. I didn't have any signs. I was not planning to protest. I just was sitting there. This is my city where I ran. Everyone in this city, they know me because I ran there. I was canvassing door to door there. My ads were there. My signs were there. I actually spoke at the Democratic Club in Royal Oak, Michigan. So it's not like I'm a random person. They know me very well. And there is a reason why they ejected me. So I want to know what is the reason. And for me, when people talk about just one issue voter, it's not about Gaza. Gaza's far away from me. It's a very important issue for me. But now it's important. What's more important, do I have place in this party or not? Is this the party of diversity and inclusion, or Muslims and Arabs don't have room anymore in this party?
Well, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Ahmed Ghanem, Muslim community leader, former Democratic congressional candidate, speaking to us from Oak Park, Michigan, on Monday, given no explanation when he was kicked out of an invitation-only Harris campaign event in Royal Oak, Michigan, to which he was invited. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Currently accepting applications for our video news production and digital fellowships. To learn more, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Aguzder, Messiah Rhodes. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
Friends support each other. Be one of Radio's best friends by becoming a CJSF supporter and making a donation during Fund Drive this year, October 28th to November 3rd.
Yo, this is Black Tech.